instead of just saying, my kids are really struggling, I have found it to be helpful to say, my kids are really struggling for now. Or this room is not right for me. This room is not right for me for now. And so that for now just relieves the pressure of finality a little bit.
This is Heart of the Story, and I'm Nadine Kenny Johnstone. I'm an author and a holistic writing coach who talks with today's top women writers about how to navigate life when things don't go according to plan. These impactful conversations and personal reflections invite you to be seen, feel supported, and ultimately fall back in love with yourself. So let's go together to that honest, powerful place, the heart of the story. Hello, my friends. Before we dive into today's incredible conversation with the beloved best-selling author, Emily P. Freeman, I just wanted to take a moment to say thank you. You have been sending the kindest notes about my guided journal, Come Home to Your Heart, and it brings me such joy to hear from you and to hear that it's having an impact on you, helping you reset, helping you get clear, helping you listen to your inner wisdom. And I wanted to offer you a thank you gift, a guided meditation to further help with that clarity and reset. It is specifically for you, the busy woman who just needs a little bit of time to listen to the directions that her heart is giving her. So if you need a reset for your day, a guided meditation to help you get still, centered, and to really relax into a clear moment, this is the meditation for you. You can find it over at my website, nadinekennyjohnstone.com/reset, and it's all yours. Now, let me tell you a little bit more about my conversation with Emily P. Freeman. She is the best-selling author of 5 books, including The Next Right Thing, which I loved, 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 and she has a new book out called How to Walk into a Room. And it's all about discerning when to stay and when to walk away. Let me tell you, I have been fangirling on Emily P. Freeman for the longest time. I've been listening to her podcast, The Next Right Thing, and her book, The Next Right Thing, helped me get through a really, really big life decision that I was making years ago. So when I heard that she had a brand new book out in the world, I couldn't wait to get my hands on it, and it did not disappoint. I dog-eared just about every page and underlined so many sentences my pen ran out of ink. So then when I got to talk to her and really get her in the flesh with all of her wisdom and kindness and humor, oh my gosh, I was just glowing. I was glowing from the conversation because she, as you will see, really makes you feel like a human being who has hard decisions to face every single day. So if you are someone who's in the midst of trying to figure out whether to leave a space, maybe it's a job, a city, a relationship, a community, or if you should stay in that space, this is the book for you. Emily talks candidly about the personal things that led to her writing the book and really how we could use the questions that she poses in order to make the best decisions for ourselves. So let's dive in to today's conversation with Emily P. Freeman. Welcome to the show, Emily.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Yes, yes, yes. So this book is all about when to stay and when to go. And I feel like so many of us think it should be an easier decision, that we should just know steadfastly one way or the other. And what I love about your work is that I think of you secretly as the queen of discernment because you help us ask the questions that lead us to make our own informed choices, because it's not a cut and dry formula for when we should stay and when we should go. So much of your work is around how to discern. To start us off, could you just walk us through a little bit of some of the examples that you share in the book from your own life of times when you approached this moment of, should I stay or should I go?
Well, thank you for that introduction. And you're so right. Don't we wish that it was easier and clearer right from the jump? And you know, there are times when it is first moment. And I would say in those times when it is, even then, sometimes we doubt ourselves and we question. And so I have found this conversation to be profoundly helpful because what it has done for me in writing it and what I hope in talking about it with others is to open the door to allow ourselves to ask ourselves the question in the first place when we begin to question a space. So one example of that for me, I went to school to be a sign language interpreter. I was thrilled to do it. I worked really hard. I got my 4-year degree. But the thing about sign language interpreting, much like probably any interpreting job like this, is you can't just get a college degree. You also have to get a certification. And so I worked hard on that after graduation. I had to pay money. I had to take time and I had to drive 6 hours to Atlanta 2 times to take a test, 2 tests, and finally got my certification. And I remember when I got it was so exciting. We celebrated. I had worked so hard for this years and years. And now I was like officially a nationally certified sign language interpreter in American Sign Language. And I did that work for a while. I was already married at the time. We didn't have any children, but time passed and I ended up becoming pregnant with twins. And when the twins were born, I realized I didn't have as much time as I once did. And it wasn't just the job, but it was also the fact that to keep that job, I had to have, and teachers would recognize this too, continuing education units. I had to keep getting trained. You know, you got the certification, now you have to keep on learning and you have to show in like records that you've done that.
Oh yeah.
And I realized that not only did I not have the capacity to like do full-time work, sign language interpreting work anymore, but I definitely didn't have the capacity or the time to get those units of continuing education. And so I found myself at a crossroads of having to decide, is this a room? It's not a bad room. It was a wonderful room, but is this a room for me now in this season of my life? And I determined that it wasn't anymore. And it was very sad, but I was also sure of it. But I still remember when I got that second letter in the mail. The first one was like, congratulations, you're in. And then the second letter years later was, unfortunately, you have not earned enough continuing education units this year and your certification has expired. And I had moved on to other things and I was writing by then a little bit and I was a mom of two, but that was a sad day. And I think that that's something important to point out is that even when we're sure that this was our next right thing, that this room wasn't for us anymore, that it can still come with pangs of regret and of, you know, a suitcase filled with sadness, as well as some gifts too. But that's one big room that I worked really hard to get into and paid money to get into, but it wasn't forever. Mm. But that doesn't mean I chose wrong in the first place. It just means that that season passed.
Mm. I've been hearing you talk about some of these things on the next right thing, and it's given me great solace and quiet companionship because I went to grad school to study creative writing. I was a professor at a university for 15 years, put a lot of time and energy and effort. And then during the pandemic, I left university teaching to start my own business. And you start to feel like, but I put all of this time and effort and energy and training and hours into something, and the history makes it harder to easily and swiftly say goodbye. But I feel like in your work, you give us permission that it doesn't have to be so, that it can be what it was, and it can still be good even if we're leaving it.
Yeah, the ending doesn't get to define the whole story. And I think we forget that because of how hard we might have worked to get someplace, or because of, this is another aspect of it, because of how much other people admire where we got to or really wanted it, you know, and they're still working for it. And you're like, not for me anymore. And that can be profoundly embarrassing. Mm-hmm. It can be, there can be some shame mixed up in there. There can be some feeling like you have to overexplain yourself to people, but some endings just, you don't get that luxury to have everyone. In fact, most endings, you don't get the luxury of having everyone understand. But that's another reason that keeps, another thing that I think has kept me in rooms maybe longer than I would have liked or were meant for me, is because of what other people are going to think.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm sure that's relatable to just about every person listening. And you also talk in the book about how change can take time. I think sometimes we think that if we're really in our integrity, then we should just know and then we should just go when it's time. But you show that change can be a process. And you have a beautiful quote in the book. You said, "Sometimes the decision to leave leads to quick movement and instant change. Often, though, leaving well actually starts with a choice to stay for now so that you can leave when the time is right. This may be years in the making, requiring patience, persistence, and a lot of grace." Talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, a lot of grace for the people who are in the room with you that you maybe would rather not be with. Just saying, sometimes that's the case. And a lot of grace for ourselves because of what you just said about some, and you kind of revealed a little narrative that you have about integrity, mm-hmm. which is if I'm acting with integrity, then I should be able to move quickly or move mm-hmm. with confidence now. And I don't know that everyone thinks that, but that reveals a little bit about how your the story you tell yourself, right? Brené Brown gave us that, that, oh, if you, integrity means mm-hmm. moving now. And someone else might say integrity means taking a really long time to make a decision. Mm-hmm. That might be their story of what it means. No matter what, though, I think grace for the moment requires us to know what our narrative is of staying or leaving, what it means to do it well, what it means to do it honestly and with integrity, and also having grace for ourselves when we're not living up to our own definition of that, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. There are times when I have maybe known in my deep heart that, like, the time has come for me to walk away from this commitment, let's just say, but I drag my feet with it. And mm-hmm. there are reasons for that, maybe. Maybe they're good reasons. Maybe they're silly reasons. But here I am, a whole person who brings with her not just her, you know, mid-40s self, but also her 16-year-old self and her 8-year-old self, who may be terrified for reasons that even I can't articulate. And I think grace for all those versions of myself that might need a little more time here, even though my, you know, 46-year-old self is ready to go. But I think finding a way to extend self-compassion is part of the discernment process, even though it's not probably a part that we would maybe love or that is easy to check off of some kind of to-do list when it comes to it.
So true. Can you think of a time in your own life when you had to offer yourself some grace in this process of making a decision?
Absolutely. I remember a time in particular where I was going through, this was several years ago, I was going through kind of a re-examination of some long-held beliefs. Mm-hmm. And I was in the middle of it. I mean, we all hopefully have those times in our lives where we pick up something that we've thought or believed or seen a certain way for a really long time. And then we're kind of questioning it or testing it, reconsidering it. And I would say, I think that's a healthy human rhythm. Mm-hmm. But when you're in the middle of it, it can feel scary. And I would also say it can feel wrong. Like maybe mm-hmm. you're going to be in trouble if you question this mm-hmm. deeply held belief that this community has. But I remember being in a room with people who, you know, were different walks of life, but we were all, you know, there for kind of a gathering we had. And there was someone in the room who started to say some things mm-hmm. that weren't, they weren't, you know, hateful things, but they were things that went against what I was learning in that moment. Things that mm-hmm. I was like, oh, wait, this person is offending like whole groups of people mm-hmm. that I am now learning to love and draw close to, whole groups of people who I know. And but this person's doing it in sort of an offhand way. And I, in the moment, like 5 alarm fire on in my body, mm-hmm. right? Like my body yeah. knew it instantly. Mm-hmm. I'm uncomfortable. Something needs to be done. But my mind and my heart could not access what to say, how to be, what to do. The idea of confronting this person felt terrifying. It felt unnatural. And it was chaotic. And all I could find myself able to do in that moment was to leave the room.
Yeah.
And upon reflection, a year or so later, even that weekend or whenever it was, not that long later, I felt a lot of shame about that because I was like, oh, if I really believe or I'm learning these things I say I'm believing and I'm learning, then I should have been able to stand up to this person, make things right, you know, speak for who I say I love or whatever. And maybe there's some truth to that. Maybe I missed an opportunity. But I would also say that there is a time for everything. And our change and our transformation doesn't happen overnight, which also means our ability to speak truth or to speak to injustice also can't happen overnight. This is something we learn and grow in. And so looking back on that, I've had to just heap loads of compassion on that version of myself who was learning, but hadn't learned yet because the learning was not fully complete. It still isn't. But I would like to say that if that were to happen now, I think I would handle it in a little bit more of an aligned way than I did then, but I wasn't ready yet. And I think that's okay.
And that's how it felt when I read that part in the book. I could feel grace on the page. I could feel self-compassion, even though I was reading about your experience. I could see my own self, hand to heart, going, okay, you've had experiences like that too. And you were so jittery with rage and also paralyzed that you didn't know what to do in the moment. And there's grace for you and there is self-compassion and you are human. And later you make different choices and you have made different choices. So know that as you shared your experiences throughout the book, it feels so resonant for a reader and it feels like it allows us to be human. That's how it felt to read the book. It felt like I can be human and I am always learning. And I don't have to be perfect in every moment. I'm still learning.
Well, I'll tell you a little behind the scenes of that story that I wrote in the book, the first draft of the book that I turned in. When I shared that story, I shared it much like I shared it with you just now, not exactly, but you know, similar beats. And when my editor sent notes back, she's the one who pointed out to me, you need to offer yourself compassion here. Mm. Like, I hear you being really harsh towards yourself here. And I don't think it's necessary because I think a reader will resonate with where you were at that time, as you just did, and will need to hear that we're allowed to be in process. Yeah. And when our bodies are deeply activated in a way that maybe we aren't used to or is new to us, it might take some practice for us to be able to have, you know, an activated nervous system and then to be able to articulate something with our voice, right? Yeah. And that alignment takes time. And so it was through that first edit. I'm so grateful for good editors. Praise the Lord for good editors. Yes. I want them to walk around with me and edit my words everywhere I go. Like, can you Same. Just do that for my whole life?
I think that, this is an app we need to have, like editor on call.
Editor app right here by my face. And there were other points in writing the book where I think I was able to offer myself compassion, but that moment in particular, I didn't see it. I didn't see it that I wasn't being that way. And she called that out. And so I was able to rewrite it with much more grace and self-compassion. I'm so grateful that she pointed it out.
Mm. And the writers who are listening, many of the listeners are writers. They're going to be taking notes in this moment about the writing tool of that, especially when we're writing creative nonfiction. How do we offer ourselves grace? We offer our other characters the grace. We make sure they come off on the page as three-dimensional characters. But when we're writing about ourselves, we're usually harsher, much harsher than we That's are right. with our characters.
Yeah.
Well, you have this really poignant analogy that just made so much sense for me about the different kind of fires, so to speak, that we face in our lives. And you graciously agreed to read a little bit from page 78 about what it's like to be facing a decision and the different kind of fires that we might be encountering.
Sure thing. I'll read from a chapter called Practice Changing Your Mind. Changing our mind can feel like being in a burning house and finally opening the front door, escaping into fresh air. And it's such a relief until you realize the very thing that saved you sent the room you left straight up in flames. Just because something burns doesn't mean you did the wrong thing by opening the door. At the same time, not all fires are created equal. And just because you feel the flame doesn't mean something has gone terribly wrong or even that you're in danger. Fire is always hot, and flames have no respect for our intention. They just set the path to burn. It's dangerous if it catches you by surprise. You don't know what you're doing, or you don't have a way out. An accidental fire has great potential for trauma and lasting pain. What if changing our minds could be less like a house fire and more like a prescribed burn, healing and expected?
This made so much sense to me, and I'd love to hear a little bit about how this came up for you and how you were able to work it through to be such a perfect analogy.
Well, I've been in the presence of some really hot fires in my life. I've thankfully never had a house fire in my own house, but I did witness a house burn down across the street from me when I was in fifth grade. And it's such a, you know, it's a core memory, really. I mean, anytime something tragic like that happens in front of you, it's going to stick. And I remember everything from the sounds to the sights to the smells. And that was a tragic day. No one was hurt in that fire, not seriously, which makes it easier to tell the story. But that image of that house across the street from us, that the structure stood on the outside, but the inside, it was almost like it didn't burn down. It burned out. It burned from the inside out. And so I would have to pass that house every day walking to school. And it looked normal. But then if you look closer, all the windows were dark and the smell was in the air for, it felt like months. I don't know if that's true, but in my mind, it was just forever. Our street smelled that way. And that was one sort of memory or moment that stuck in my mind. But a second one was many years later, my husband, John, and I were in Florida, and we ended up passing by, you know, I didn't know what was happening at the time. It looked like a forest fire in Florida. Yeah. This was January in Florida. And we were on the highway and kind of stopped in traffic. And the whole forest on the side of the road was up in flames. But as we got closer, I realized, like, no, there were people standing by. There were firefighters and professional fire people standing by and guarding. And it looked like they were very much in control, even though the flames were raging, just like that house across the street. And, you know, we had to pass right by it on the road. I rolled my window down. And this was, you know, January in Florida. It was a record cold. I remember it was really cold. But it was, when I rolled that window down, it was, the flames hit my face, very hot. And that memory also sticks. But I think about these two bookended type of fires where one was out of control and raging, unexpected and scary. The other one was controlled, planned, probably on someone's schedule. And it was set for a purpose, a good purpose, to clear out the brush and to prevent something worse happening later. But both fires were hot. The flames really were no respecter of what the purpose was. They just burn what's there. But I think sometimes changing our mind or reconsidering something, or even the story that we just shared about being in a room where you realize you're in the process of changing your mind on something, but no one else around you is, and you're feeling that activated sense in your body, like something's happening and you feel like you're the one on fire, that sometimes changing our mind feels like that house fire, like everything's being ruined. I'm going to leave out the front door, but it's going to make the whole place go up in flames even more if I walk out of here. It's scary. It happens in the night. You know, there's just a lot of anxiety-ridden things that can happen when you feel like you're reconsidering something that maybe a space that you belong to would never reconsider, you know, whether that's a small thing or a big thing. But I do think that there is a way, I hope that there's a way for changing our minds, or being willing to change our minds, to be more of a part of our process that we go through as grownups. That, as Sharon McMahon says, that when we receive new and better information, the ethical thing to do is to change our minds based on new and better information. And that's more like the prescribed burn. Something still goes away. Yeah. Something still burns. Something's still gone. But there's a controlled aspect to it. There's an expectation that I'm going to change my mind as I grow, instead of like, I mean, I hope I'm not the same as I was when I was 21. I hope that this process is something that I can, that's guarded and that's expected, and that is going to change and things are going to fall away and new things are going to grow. That's what I hope for. But I think sometimes we need someone to cast that vision for us, because so often change and reconsideration feels like a house fire.
That's exactly how I felt after reading that passage, is this change of perspective that we can expect that as we grow, we are going to change our minds, and that we can actually have that be a purposeful thing and almost an expected thing that we will change our minds. I think there's a lot of shame put on when we don't stay at the same place or in the same job or in the same community or at the same church or in the same group of friends. There is this pressure to make something last forever. And that's just not what I see in real life. People change their minds all the time. But you have this beautiful quote in the book that so resonated, that you said, in leaving, oftentimes we feel left. I underlined that thing over and over again. Tell us about that, and why is that?
You know, when I look back on my own life, and I've been in a room, and when I say room, I just mean I've been a part of a community, or I've been part of had a something that I'm committed to, that I feel like I belong, where I feel like I belong. When I've been the one who stays and someone else decides their time has come to leave, and I watch them leave, sometimes, and I'm guilty of this, I have thought in my mind, like, well, it was their choice to leave, so they're not allowed to be sad about it. Like, they could have stayed. Why? If they're so sad about it, why didn't they stay? It's until you're the one who's leaving, when you realize the intricacies of the decision to leave in the first place.
Yes.
And it depends on what it's about, obviously. But in particular, if you're leaving a space that had some really good and beautiful things about it that you loved, but there's something about it, some shift that has happened either in you or in the room itself, that you've just realized this is not aligning anymore. This is not a place for me anymore. And you're the one who's leaving. Now you realize, like, I would have stayed were things different. I would be here still if things remained as I thought they would remain, or if things grew in the direction I thought we were going, or when I started this thing and we all started it together, I thought we were headed one way, but it turns out the community's going another way. And that's not what I signed up for. And that's not what I wanted. Mm-hmm. And so you feel like, though you may be the one who left ultimately, you might be standing at a years long journey of having felt left over and over again when you were still in the room. And I think that's something that I didn't understand when I was the one who felt great where I was. You know, I felt great in this space, this community, this commitment. But until I was the one walking out, I couldn't fully understand all of the losses that probably often lead up to the person who finally walks out the door.
I think readers will feel so seen in these chapters, and in particular with that notion, because I think, as you said, we don't truly know how painful it can be, even if we're making the choice to go. We truly don't realize how painful that is until we're the one walking away. And it is a very layered and complex experience. And I really appreciated, as a reader, that you gave multiple personal examples of times when there's a loving of most parts of a thing, but there's something that just isn't quite fitting our ideals or values or whatever, and it's time to go, and it can be really painful because there's so much good. And so you had a really beautiful passage about how in 2020, most of us kind of experienced some kind of shift. And sometimes we didn't even know that the last time we did something was going to be the last time. We moved from Chicagoland area to Florida in 2022. And even some of the last rituals, even though I knew our move was coming, it was like, oh, that was the last time I bounced on the trampoline with my son in my own yard. And you don't even realize that that's going to be the last time in a place or space. So you have a passage on 121 that you are going to share with us about that very experience.
That is sometimes the reality of our endings, and certainly happened for a lot of us during 2020. No foreshadowing, no runway, no warning, just regular life, straight into an abrupt ending. For anyone who left or was left that year, for anyone who lost someone they loved that year, for anyone who was let go from a job or lost their home or moved away, the unformed endings just faded into our lives without boundaries or markings. The endings we got were nothing like the endings we always imagined would be, if we imagined the endings at all.
So we've talked a bit about making a choice to walk away, but this is talking about endings that are kind of thrust upon us. And what have you noticed about that experience when we're going through endings we didn't necessarily see coming?
Those are some of the hardest ones because, you know, when we have an anticipated ending, there's a lead up. It's almost like we're grieving as we go along. But when an ending happens abruptly or it takes you by surprise, especially if it's a place where you wanted to stay, then you're having to process not only the goodbye and the sadness, but also the what could have been betrayal or the sometimes there might have been a backstabbing that happened. Like there's a lot of other things that happen when an ending is a surprise or when it takes you by surprise. And one of those things is you rarely get closure because this was not something you could plan for. It just, here it is, boom.
Yep.
And I don't know if I'm ready to say this fully yet, but there is a part of me that feels like in many ways closure is a myth anyway. Yeah. Like I think there are times when we get it, but they're rare. It's usually with anticipated endings like graduations, weddings, which are the beginning of something, but also the ending of something else, retirements. These are the times that we toast. These are the times that we give cheers and we give hugs and goodbyes. And we have these communal ritualistic ways of offering closure. But when it comes to a surprise ending or a death or a letting go from a job or getting kicked out of a space or being unfriended, there's a lot of things to process and it takes a lot of time. And so I think for anyone who is struggling with that type of ending, what I have found helpful is though you may not have gotten the ending that you wanted or the tied up ends that you maybe hope for or look for when it comes to an ending, what I think we can do is fight for closure that we need. And it might not really look like closure from the outside, but for me, that looks like putting a period on something in my own way. One of the ways I do that is I name in my own time, and I even write this down, bullet point style. I'll name what were the gifts of that room. So what am I going to bring with me? Even if it ended terribly, the ending doesn't get to have the final say always. It might have been the last thing that happened, but it wasn't the only thing that happened. And so I get to look at that room and say, what are the gifts of that room I'm bringing with me? And I also get to look at that room and say, what am I not going to bring with me? What am I going to leave in that room? Because it won't fit through the door. And sometimes the thing you have to leave in the room is the story you never got to tell. It's the explanation you never were afforded the time to give. And it's the understanding that you never got or the explanation that you never got to hear. Sometimes we try to take that stuff with us. And I think what that does is it keeps us caught in the threshold and we aren't able to move on because we're constantly trying to fit this giant thing through a really small doorway. And I would encourage in your own time, as you're able, to just gently leave that in the room, the lack of closure that you wanted. And by naming that that isn't there, sometimes that's the closure that you actually need.
I think it speaks to so many of my loved ones I've watched go through an ending they weren't expecting, whether being laid off from a job or a friendship that just kind of fizzled out and ghosted. And there's this why in the replay in the mind. So I think all those words of wisdom you just gave give us peace in our own hearts to name what was good, know that the ending doesn't define the entire thing, and leave behind whatever narratives we've been trying to create in our own minds. I think it's so wise. And you also were talking about when we leave a room, we don't walk into nothing. Something new is always waiting. This gave so much hope, but maybe you can talk a little bit about how you came to understand that or what that means to you.
Well, it's funny. In a book called How to Walk Into a Room, I sure spent a lot of time talking about how to walk out. In fact, we toyed with calling the book How to Walk Out of a Room, but that felt negative. I don't know. But I guess the thing is in order to walk into a room, we don't walk into a room blank slate. It's like a novelist, when you're writing a novel, not that I've written a novel, but I've read a lot about it. I've read a lot of novels. When you open that first page, there's an understanding in the reader that this is a story that's already happening. It's not in the beginning someone was born. No, this is a fully formed human with fully formed experiences that are unfolded as time goes on, as we read. The same goes for every room we walk into. When we start something new, we just came from something else. Unless you're a newborn baby, that we all had our first room and that was the last time we had our first room. We don't get that again. And we bring all of those stories and all of those endings with us. And I think it's important to notice and to name that how we are formed as people informs how we walk into a room. And that includes what we're bringing with us from the last room and what we decided or chose or had to leave behind. And so for me, I think it's important before I talk about and think about what the new thing is I'm walking into, for me, I found it to be so helpful and transformative to know and name the things I just left. Otherwise, we're just coming in with a whole big bunch of stuff in every room we enter, disappointments, griefs, unnamed endings, things that were kind of loose-ended, and we sometimes will try to start, I'm going to start something new. It's like, yeah, but what's the old though? And what are we going to leave so that we have room to grow in this new space? And I think that idea of something new is always waiting, because I have just always found that to be true. There's not one time I've left something when there wasn't something new waiting. That doesn't necessarily mean something good is always waiting, but it will be new and there will be gifts and burdens with that as well. And I think that helps me to not villainize the rooms I've left and to know that that room had good too for a time. And then that time passed. But it can be hard to move forward because we know what we're leaving. Even if it's not great, at least we know it. At least there's no surprises there. But knowing that, yeah, but the next thing is going to have, it's going to have some great and it's going to have some terrible. Because that's what it means to be human.
And you had this analogy of the homes, the idea of we so badly are wanting that feeling that you encountered a person of faith who was talking about how I think it was he wanted to, he was going to stay in that space forever. And you wrote about wanting desperately that feeling of like, wouldn't it be so nice to have that feeling of, yeah, I'm going to stay in this space forever.
Yeah, right.
And it got me thinking so much. I wrote a chapter called Forever Home about this very idea of when we bought our first home when my husband and I were newlyweds living in Massachusetts. And so many quirks about it were never going to actually work for a full family. But I remember the realtor saying to us as we were walking through the space to look at it, to buy it, and seeing all its quirks that we just thought were fantastic, that it was on a busy road, that it had this tiny one bathroom. And he was like, you know, okay, so when you guys go to resell it, you're going to have to deal with this. And I said, resell it? What? And he said, well, the average person sells a house every 5 years, roughly. And I was angry. I was angry at this man.
How dare you?
But later, I looked at him and I realized, you know, here he was. He was a man in his 60s. He had just lost his wife to breast cancer. He had seen a lot of things and he knew a lot of things that I did not yet know at 28 or however old I was. And I so badly, though, wanted that forever home. And I wanted in all areas of my life. We're on number, I think, seven of the forever home at this point.
That's
But
good.
you came to this idea of the internal home towards the end of the book. And maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Well, so much of my story, and I think a lot of our stories, is navigating what it means to leave beloved spaces. Spaces, whether it's a home that we where we raised our children or where we grew up, or home where our parents lived, or whether it's a community of people and we had to move away for whatever reason. And those are beloved spaces. But I think I have begun to make peace with the reality that I am the beloved space.
Mm.
That means that I bring home with me wherever I go, because there is one person I'm going to be with forever, and it's me. And so the sooner I recognize, show grace toward, offer compassion to this friend who is myself, the sooner I think I will find some confidence and flourishing in the rooms that I exit and enter, because I'm going with me wherever I go. And so I think it's high time I learn to be my own friend.
Yes. There's a quote, "The longest and most passionate love affair you'll ever have is the one with your very own soul." And you came up with a sort of mantra, a two-word mantra that helps a lot whenever people wanted something to be long and permanent, but it isn't. And so the words that you repeat are "for now." And maybe you can tell us a bit about that.
Two-word mantras are becoming my favorite type of prayer because they're very simple, they're easy to remember, and they can be any two words that you want. But I have found "for now" to be such a relief when I, especially when I'm in the midst of, like you said, an ending I didn't want or ask for, or a struggle that seems to have no end. And so instead of just saying, you know, "my kids are really struggling," I have found it to be helpful to say, "my kids are really struggling for now," or "this room is not right for me. This room is not right for me for now." Because that leaves the door a little bit open to know that if I feel a deep sense of grief that this room isn't right for me, that maybe it's not final. Maybe I will grow and change, and maybe I'll come back around here. Maybe there will be a part of this room that I'll bring with me, and we'll make a new room that's even better. And so that "for now" I have found just relieves the pressure of finality a little bit. And I think that we can pull any two words, you know, another one is "let go," or "I'm here," or even you can come up with one word like, "well, you know, we're struggling, but I think adding the word together is sometimes helpful," like, "but I'm not alone," you know? So just finding ways to re-language some of these hard moments where we can honestly get pretty stuck, I have found two-word mantras to be just a little bit of a lifeline to get things moving again.
Well, you shared, as we wrap things up, about things that you know for sure or that you've learned over time. And I would love for you to read some of them to us on page 147.
Here are a few things I know for sure. I know that being confident about what you want to do or where you want to be does not guarantee you'll get it any more than being unsure guarantees you won't. I know that it's possible to be rooted even if you're in motion, just as it's possible to be scattered even if you're staying in one place. I know that having doubts and questions about what you want to do or where you want to live or who you hope to become does not mean you don't have a home. I know that finding where you belong is not a one-time decision, and uncovering your belonging is slow, important work.
I feel so grateful to have spoken with you today, and for everyone who's listening who finds themselves in the midst of a core decision. This book is just a treasure trove of gems and gifts for discernment. It will make you feel seen. It will make you feel deep self-compassion, and it will be a wonderful guide for you to reflect and make a decision that feels right for you, whether it takes a long time or a short time. This is a beautiful, not only guide, but a companion as well. So thank you, thank you, thank you for being on today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Oh my goodness. Wasn't she just an absolute delight? I got so many nuggets from this conversation, and I hope that you did too. And if you did, will you let us know? I'm on Instagram at Nadine Kenny Johnstone, and Emily's on Instagram at Emily P. Freeman. Share it with a friend that you think could use this episode and tag us and let us know how it impacted you. Remember, if you are looking for a 20-minute reset to find stillness and really listen to what your heart is saying, you can get that meditation and journaling mini retreat video over at nadinekennyjohnstone.com/reset, and I'll put the link in the show notes. I know someone who always helps me figure out the best decisions around this podcast, and her name is Michelle Rado, my dear producer. Thank you, Michelle, for all that you do. Remember, everyone, every heart has a story, and every story has a heart. See you next week.